picture the balance in your checking account right now. Just visualize those digits on your screen. What if I told you that money doesn't actually exist?
Yeah, it's not sitting in a vault somewhere.
Right, it's not backed by bars of gold. In fact, almost every dollar you see was, well, literally created out of thin air the exact moment someone somewhere went into debt. Today, we are tearing down the illusion of wealth.
Because we navigate our whole lives around those digits, you know? But we usually only understand the surface mechanics of survival, like how to earn it, how to spend it.
Exactly.
But if you look under the hood, you realize money is this vast, invisible matrix of legal architectures, enforceable obligations, and institutional trust.
And to help decode that matrix, we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating piece from American newspaper and American TV. It's called Money, Capitalism, and the Architecture of Wealth.
It's a fantastic breakdown.
It really is. And our mission today is to map out money as humanity's core social operating system. We're going to explore how commercial banks literally birth currency into existence, why debt is fundamentally a time travel device, and the hidden structures the ultra-wealthy use to make sure their capital survives for
That's
centuries.
going to change how you look at everything.
Oh, absolutely. We are going to shatter some deeply held myths today,
Yeah.
especially the idea that a massive salary automatically makes you wealthy.
Yeah, that is perhaps the most dangerous trap for high achievers.
Yeah.
But to grasp why earning a lot doesn't equal having a lot, we have to look at the source code of this financial operating system.
Right.
And that means skipping past the elementary history of, people trading cows for wheat and looking directly at the moment money transformed from a physical object into pure information.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because that upgrade to version 2.0 is where the modern world actually
I
begins.
got it.
We moved from lugging around heavy gold or silver to using paper claims and double entry accounting. Money stopped being a heavy metal and became a ledger, a record of who owes what.
Right. And what's fascinating here is that the transition to a ledger paved the way for the gold standard, which was an attempt to keep this new paper system tethered to physical reality.
So keeping it grounded.
Right. The promise was fixed convertibility. Your paper currency was a claim ticket for a specific ounce of gold. It was designed to impose ultimate financial discipline on governments. But that exact discipline became its fatal flaw.
Wait, discipline sounds like a good thing. Why is being tethered to a physical asset a flaw?
Because economies are dynamic and gold is static. Think about a massive crisis, like a banking panic, a world war, or a severe depression.
Okay, things are going bad.
Really bad. In those moments, an economy desperately needs liquidity. It needs the money supply to flex and expand to keep businesses open and people employed. But if your money supply is strictly tied to the amount of shiny rock in a vault,
You're just stuck.
you can't flex. The gold standard forced catastrophic deflation. People hoarded cash. Banks collapsed, and the rigidity of the system drove massive unemployment.
Wow.
That's exactly why the United States had to suspend domestic convertibility in the 1930s and completely sever the dollar from gold internationally in 1971.
Which leaves us with fiat money. And this is where a lot of people throw their hands up and say, well, it's all fake then. It's unbacked paper.
I hear that all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
But that is a complete misunderstanding of the architecture. It's not unbacked. It's backed by the state accepting it for taxes. It's backed by courts enforcing contracts written in it.
It is institutionalized trust. The risk of modern money isn't that the gold vault is empty. The real risk is institutional failure.
Right.
If a government engages in massive fiscal abuse or there's rampant corruption, the trust evaporates. And when trust evaporates, the currency collapses, regardless of what's printed on the paper.
But hold on. If fiat relies entirely on institutions and trust, doesn't that just mean it's backed by politicians? And historically speaking, politicians have a pretty terrible track record of managing money without eventually diluting it to zero. Why should we trust that?
Well, it's completely valid skepticism, and we're not taking sides on whether they do a perfect job. But that's exactly why central banks are typically designed to be independent from the political branches of government.
To build a firewall.
Exactly. Now, whether they always maintain that independence is a subject of constant debate. But the goal of the architecture is to separate the power to spend money from the power to create it. Central banks aren't just printers of money. They anchor the system by influencing short-term interest rates and acting as lenders of last resort.
Which brings us to the most mind-bending part of this whole system. If we aren't mining gold out of the earth and the central bank isn't just printing pallets of cash and handing it to me when I buy a house, where is my $300,000 mortgage actually coming from? How does money enter the ledger?
Yeah, this is the illusion we have to break. Most people think commercial banks are intermediaries.
Like middlemen.
Right. You think someone deposits $10,000 into their savings account and the bank turns around and lends that exact $10,000 to you? That is not how modern banking works.
It's not.
Not at all. When a commercial bank approves your mortgage, they don't go looking for someone else's savings. They simply type the digits into your account.
Wait. So when I take out a mortgage, the bank isn't just handing me someone else's savings. They're expanding their balance sheet and creating that deposit liability in the moment. How is that not a recipe for disaster?
It sounds like an infinite money glitch, right?
Yeah, it sounds completely reckless.
But while banks expand their balance sheets, they are heavily constrained by reality. They face strict capital requirements, regulatory hurdles, and their own liquidity needs. Most importantly, they are bound by credit underwriting.
So they can't just lend to anyone.
Right. If a bank types $1 billion into existence and loans it to people who can't pay it back, the asset side of the bank's ledger vaporizes and the bank goes bankrupt.
So the creation of money is entirely tethered to the belief that future human productivity will pay off that debt, which makes debt like a time machine.
A time machine, I like that.
Yeah, it's a mechanism that lets you pull your future purchasing power into the present.
And the toll you pay to use that time machine is the interest rate. Interest rates are fundamentally the price of time, you know, adjusted for the credit risks that you might not pay it back, and the expectation of inflation.
Let's make this tangible, because financial jargon like discount rates usually puts people to sleep. If we talk about converting future cash flows into present value, explain that like I'm five.
Okay, imagine I promise to give you $100, but I tell you I'm not going to hand it over for 10 years.
I'm definitely not giving you $100 today for that.
Exactly. You discount it. You might say, I'll give you $50 today for the promise of $100 in a decade. That mathematical penalty for making you wait is the discount rate. When interest rates are low across the economy, the penalty for waiting is small. So assets that pay off in the distant future, like tech startups or real estate, become highly valuable today.
Yeah.
But the moment interest rates spike,
that penalty goes way up.
Right. The present value of all those future assets plummets.
Which dictates how you should use the time machine of debt. If you take on productive debt, you are financing an asset that out-earns the cost of borrowing. You use the time machine to buy a factory that prints cash.
Yes.
But destructive debt, that's financing a depreciating lifestyle asset. You are literally stealing from your future self to buy a luxury car today, paying interest on an asset that is losing value every single month.
And that variable, how you use debt and how you experience time, dictates your entire position in the economy. The operating system is the exact same for everyone, but the user experience is drastically different depending on which rung of the economic ladder you stand on.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's look at that wealth ladder from the source material. The bottom rung is the experience of poverty, where money is purely emergency liquidity.
Right.
When you are on this rung, the central crisis isn't market volatility, it's life volatility. A blown transmission on your only car or a sudden medical bill doesn't just hurt, it completely derails you.
Because of that constant scarcity, you have zero bargaining power. You end up paying a massive premium just to participate in the system.
Overdraft fees, payday loans.
Astronomical interest rates.
Yeah.
Higher insurance premiums. The financial strategy here cannot be about complex asset allocation. It has to be ruthlessly focused on income shock defense, building a basic buffer so the next pothole doesn't put you on the street.
Move up a rung and you hit the middle class. Here, money is experienced as consumption and stability, mortgages, retirement accounts, saving for college.
But there is a massive psychological trap at this level.
Confusing social respectability with actual financial independence.
Exactly.
You can have the beautiful house, the leased SUVs, the kids in sports looking incredibly successful. But if those lifestyle obligations consume 99% of your monthly paycheck, you aren't wealthy. Your balance sheet is a house of cards.
You are one layoff away from disaster. You're completely dependent on the continuous sale of your labor to sustain the illusion of wealth, which naturally leads us to the high income earners, the surgeons, the corporate executives, the successful consultants.
Right, the people making the big buck.
For them, money is proof of skill and status.
And this is the misconception we have to destroy right now, pointing out that a massive salary does not make you wealthy. A salary is just a cash flow stream.
Just a stream, yeah.
Yeah. And worse, it's ordinary income, meaning it is taxed at the absolute highest possible legal rates. If a high earner takes their $500,000 salary and inflates their lifestyle to match it, you know, country club memberships, second homes, private schools, they are simply funneling cash through their fingers. They are consuming their income rather than converting it into durable assets.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it comes down to understanding the hierarchy of earning power. At the bottom of the hierarchy, you sell your time and physical labor. It doesn't scale.
Yeah.
Above that, you sell your professional judgment or specialized skills. That's the high income earner. But the pinnacle of economic power comes from removing your own time from the equation entirely. It comes from owning productive systems, owning capital, owning businesses, owning intellectual property.
Which is how the truly wealthy view the world. They transition from needing a paycheck to storing value to holding an asset portfolio. They focus on cash flow, tax efficiency, and optionality.
Yes. And at the absolute apex, the billionaires and ultra high net worth individuals, they understand money as control over large systems.
They use money to shape industries.
Exactly. Industries, narratives, and rules. The transition is moving from needing money to storing it to owning claims to governing institutions. They transition from playing by the rules to shaping the rules of the operating system itself.
So the critical question becomes, how do you actually cross that chasm? How do you move from merely earning a high income to locking in durable institutional wealth?
It comes down to the hidden architecture of preservation and law. You have to contrast earning money, which involves taking risks, with preserving money, which is about avoiding permanent impairment.
So what does this all mean? It's like playing a sport. Earning money is your offense, but preserving it through legal structures and avoiding big interruptions is your defense. You can't win a championship without defense. Let's look at wealth preservation as building a watertight ship.
Oh, I love this analogy.
Generating cash flow is the engine moving the ship forward. But defense isn't just about sailing slowly. It's about engineering bulkheads into the hull of your ship. If you hit a reef, maybe a lawsuit, a market crash, a business failure, water floods into one compartment, but the bulkheads prevent the entire ship from sinking.
That is exactly how you have to view legal and financial structures.
Yeah.
And it requires understanding the difference between volatility and permanent impairment. Most retail investors think risk is the stock market going down 20%.
Which is scary, but...
it's just volatility. You wait it out, it recovers. Permanent impairment means the money is gone forever and the compounding curve is broken.
Give me an example of permanent impairment in the real world.
Margin calls are a classic example. Say you borrow money from your broker to buy stocks, aiming for higher returns. The market takes a sudden 30% dive. Your broker demands you deposit more cash immediately to cover the risk.
And if you don't have it?
They forcefully liquidate your portfolio at the absolute bottom of the market. When the market inevitably recovers a year later, you aren't participating. You are flushed out. That is permanent impairment.
Ouch.
It also comes from illiquidity, like having all your wealth locked up in a private company and suddenly needing cash to pay a massive tax bill or settle a divorce. You are forced to sell a great asset for pennies on the dollar.
Which is why the engineering of those watertight bulkheads is so vital. We are talking about the legal architecture of wealth. And let's be explicitly clear, we are not talking about tax evasion. Hiding money offshore illegally is a crime.
Definitely.
We are talking about legitimate tax and legal planning, which is simply understanding the law and using its boundaries to your advantage, like entity choice, timing, deductions. Wealth isn't just cash, it's money embedded in legal entities.
Take an LLC, a limited liability company. It's not just a piece of paper for a small business. It is a literal bulkhead.
Yeah.
If you own a rental property in an LLC and someone slips, falls, and sues, they are suing the entity that owns the property. They generally cannot pierce through that structure to come after your personal bank account or your primary residence. It legally segregates liability.
And trusts go even further. A trust fundamentally splits the concept of ownership in half. It separates the legal title of an asset from the beneficial enjoyment of it.
That is a profound tool. I mean, if you put assets into certain types of irrevocable trusts, you no longer legally own them. The trust does.
Mm-hmm.
But the trust is instructed to pay out the income to your children.
So you get the benefits, but not the risk.
Because you don't legally own the assets anymore, your personal creditors can't touch them. It is the ultimate defense mechanism against the chaos of the outside world.
Which leads to the creation of family offices. For the ultra-wealthy, managing these bulkheads becomes so complex that they literally build their own private institutions.
Oh, family offices are fascinating. They act as private institutions for wealth administration. It's not just a guy picking stocks. It's an entire organization employing tax attorneys, estate planners, cybersecurity experts, and investment managers under one roof.
All working just for one family?
Yes. Their sole mandate is to ensure the capital survives everything from a global recession to a sophisticated cyber attack. They are institutionalizing that defense through coordinated tax planning and governance. They are managing the greatest enemy of wealth, which is interruption.
Right, because compound interest is doing the heavy lifting.
Exactly. Compound interest, converting time into capital, only produces its miraculous exponential results if it's left alone. If you constantly interrupt compounding with devastating tax hits from excessive trading or forced liquidations or massive legal lawsuits, you reset the math. The family office exists to prevent interruption.
Okay, so the ship is perfectly watertight. The bulkheads are in place, the investments are compounding smoothly, but eventually we hit the final unavoidable crisis of the financial operating system. What happens when the captain of the ship dies?
Generational transfer. It is the ultimate test, and it is where most family fortunes are completely destroyed. We tend to think of inheritance as a tax minimization problem, but fundamentally it is a governance problem.
Let's break that down. A lot of people think, I'll just write a will, leave it all to my kids, and I'm done. Why is that a disaster waiting to happen?
Because a simple will is incredibly rudimentary. A will only directs probate assets. Probate is a public, court-supervised legal process of paying your debts and distributing what's left. It's slow, it's entirely public, meaning anyone can look up exactly what you left and to whom.
Which sounds like a nightmare for a wealthy family.
It invites family conflict and creditor claims. But more importantly, it simply moves the title of an asset. It does absolutely nothing to solve heir preparedness.
Yeah, I mean, I can leave a house or a stock portfolio to someone easily enough, but how on earth do you leave them the ability to manage it? Doesn't inherited wealth actually have the power to destroy an heir if this governance piece is missing?
This raises an important question, because there's a massive psychological problem with inherited assets. Think about the wealth creator. They learned how to handle risk by taking it. They started the business. They almost went bankrupt twice. They endured sleepless nights. They built resilience.
They earned the judgment.
Right. But the heir, they received the capital without enduring the crucible. They might learn consumption before stewardship. If a young adult suddenly inherits $10 million in highly liquid assets without governance, they will almost always blow it.
There is a concept from the text that captures this perfectly. The central law of generational transfer. Quote, assets can be transferred faster than judgment.
That is the core of the issue. You can transfer a $10 million brokerage account with a signature on a Tuesday. It takes decades to transfer the financial literacy, the emotional restraint, and the strategic vision required to not blow that account by Friday. Money is ultimately a magnifying glass.
It amplifies behaviors.
It takes whatever habits, flaws, or virtues you currently have and scales them up massively. Hand massive liquidity to someone without institutional thinking, and the wealth will inevitably fracture.
So the solution isn't just restricting the heirs, locking the money away in a rigid trust where the kids get a tiny allowance and hate you forever. True governance means providing education early.
Yes.
Giving staged incremental responsibility. Maybe they manage a small philanthropic fund first to learn how to allocate capital together as a family. It's about building a family culture that clearly separates the rights of inheritance from the responsibilities of stewardship.
It requires engineering the family culture with the same precision that you engineer a tax strategy.
We've covered massive ground today. We've seen that money is much more than paper in a wallet. It is a complex ledger of institutional trust. We've demystified how banks expand their balance sheets to create the credit that powers our lives, effectively acting as a time travel device.
A very powerful device.
We've exposed the difference between high income and durable wealth along that economic ladder, and why defensive legal architectures like LLCs and trusts are the actual bulkheads of the rich. And we face the ultimate reality that passing on wealth, that legal architecture that outlives its creators, is useless without passing on wisdom.
The operating system of money is running all around us, whether we understand the code or not.
Exactly. So let's circle back to where we started. Picture those digits in your banking app one more time. If assets truly transfer faster than judgment and money simply amplifies human behavior, take a look at your own non-financial balance sheet today. What specific judgments, skills, or personal frameworks are you actively compounding right now to ensure your wisdom grows as fast as your bank account? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.